everyone, and welcome back to a midweek miracle episode. I have more time in my life these days, so I'm hoping that this summer I'm able to release 2 episodes a week. So with that in mind, let me introduce you to my guest this time, Mitch Carson. Mitch is a celebrated professional speaker, and he's been on stages in 63 countries, if you can believe that, and also produced over 2,000 live events. He's also a published author, and he's a mentor. He's mentored CEOs, speakers, consultants, and other coaches, and he shared the stage with Sir Richard Branson, Lord Sugar, Vishen Lakhani, Zig Ziglar, Surya Sparks, 2 prime ministers, and 3 members of royal families from Malaysia, Bahrain, and Oman. But it was really our conversation this week that struck me. It's all about belonging, how we find our families, and hint, they might not be our biological families, and how we find community with which to belong to. Mitch has several beautiful stories to tell just about his life, and then, of course, his miracle moment. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Mitch Carson.
In 1983, my mother and stepfather passed away 5 weeks apart, and I was an only child. I was devastated, felt abandoned emotionally and literally, and went on a downward spiral of drugs and alcohol.
So my first question for everybody is, how do you self-describe? If you had to go to a party or a conference and you had to introduce yourself, how would you do that?
It depends on what environment. If I'm there for business, I have a canned elevator pitch. And depending on, so it's well-rehearsed. It's reactive. You can bonk me on the head if I'm in a deep sleep and I'll come out of it and they say, Mitch, what do you do? And I'll have something that'll spew out of my mouth, which will be damn good because I've practiced it so many times. So that's where I would use it in that environment. If I'm in a social environment and I'm not there to pitch or talk my product, it really depends. So I'm going to ask you to ask me a more specific question, describe where I am, and then I can answer accordingly. Is that fair?
Yes, that's fair. I do ask some of my guests this, and just by virtue of what you do now, when you were a kid, did you imagine or envision kind of that you'd be doing what you're doing now?
Absolutely, unequivocally, no. I am in a completely different direction. And somebody asked me this question. I don't know if it was on a podcast or it might have been in a social environment. What did you want to do? It was a podcast. Now I remember. What did you want to do? What did you imagine when you were a kid? And I think it varied based on my time frame and background. So, when I was in the first grade, when the fireman came in and he climbed up on his ladder and we got to watch the fire truck and the fireman went up on the ladder and said, I want to do that. That's so cool. And he had a big hose that blasted water, so that was my first. And then the following week, Mr. Policeman came in from the local police force. And he had a cool gun and a belt, and I liked his uniform, so that was a fascination, neither of which I pursued when I got older or came of age to look for a career. But I did like that first exposure. And then I think when I became an adult, I had the idea, because I had some physical challenges from an auto accident I was in and a motorcycle crash, I thought about becoming a chiropractor.
So was there a separate motorcycle and then auto accident, or was it incident?
I had a motorcycle accident first, and that set me out to then I had to go seek treatment because I had some problems in my back and hip, and a chiropractor was the one that helped me. And then I had another accident that came about. And then I'd recently had an auto accident, but that's unrelated to my career question. So.
Yeah, I go to see chiropractors and I think sometimes, my God, I wish everybody could avail themselves of this kind of methodology because it is very, very effective and amazing. It's amazing work. And depending on the chiropractor, it can be very subtle. And you might leave and think, oh my goodness, nothing. Did anything happen? And then maybe over the following days and weeks, things start shifting and changing. I think that's amazing that you considered that. So are you surprised by where you've ended up?
I am absolutely surprised, but this came not by design. At least that was my notion when I got into doing what I do today. It's just where life took me. You know, we've heard the proverbial life's a journey. Well, in fact, it is. It's written by some people that typically are older and more mature and can look back in hindsight and realize, okay, this has been my path. There are some things, would I change it? Sure. I have a couple of regrets, you know, but that's spilled milk and you just move forward.
Would you mind just describing what it is you do for my audience in your own words?
Sure. I do three things. I run workshops for people, teaching them how to get the book out of their head onto paper, to write a book very quickly, get it published, and how to become a best-selling author on Amazon. New York Times is a different pitch. I also train people in the world of professional speaking, how to pitch and sell from the stage. Different than keynoting, which is a different specialty. So my focus is selling and converting. And then the third thing is I have a publicist here in Las Vegas where I guarantee people to get on network television.
Well, I have to admit that, yes, I do love meeting people like this. This is comfortable for me, but getting up on a stage and having to talk to like multiple human beings and having the spotlight makes me want to go throw up everywhere. And so were you ever scared of getting on that stage?
100% I was nervous. And the first time I spoke on stage, I threw up in the bathroom. So the emotion that you're describing is very real. And it was something I had to overcome because without any pain, there is no gain. We've heard that expression. So it is a process.
I'm just curious also, you know, on your bio, it says that you worked at the Home Shopping Network. And I think, you know, doing that and speaking there, was that, is it similar to being on stage or is it very different?
Very different. Because I had up to 5 million viewers on television. This was in the 90s. Okay. So back then it had a much higher viewership. Today we have Amazon and we have so much competition. People aren't buying that way today. They're buying online where it's a lot different. So yes, that was a great training to articulate messages, how to create hooks around products and or services, which I used in my professional speaking career. And I had a background creating short form infomercials. And short form infomercials, that means less than 2 minutes. They're long form, which are the 30 minute or hour long, different format. But I've done that subsequently. But during that time, I created short form infomercials, which we would cut to when I was selling products on Home Shopping Network.
Okay, got it. And I have to say, honestly, just talking with you, what really hits me is creative artist. Would you accept those titles?
Oh, 100%. Someone called me a director recently, and I guess I do because I direct people with their messages in creating value and clarity in their messages.
Amazing. I love it. That's such a huge compliment. How awesome. Wow. Well, and then also what I find, you know, before we even started the interview, we were talking about you, you know, visiting, traveling, living in all these other places. And, you know, how did that come about?
In 2006, I did something legal, which is called a divorce. And then I decided at that point, the focus, it was a very difficult time where my focus changed from making money to then living life. And I wanted to be a digital nomad and do some consulting work from afar and go live in different countries. I mean, sort of similar to what you're doing.
Absolutely. Well, I do think I'd love to pick your brain about this, but what is one of your favorite places that you've ever, you know, visited or worked from around the world?
Okay, I've lived in 7 countries, visited 63. There are pros and cons to each. There are some places that I would never return to, no matter what. And there are places which I would welcome to return to. So if I, in terms of living, Thailand was the best place to live. And it was so Western friendly, safe, great food, great medical, inexpensive, and kind people. So I liked it for that. For business, I like the sharp minds of Singaporeans and Japanese. There's no language barrier in Singapore because they all speak English. I really like that. I like some of the people in Dubai, which have a very strong business mindset. And that was also quite enjoyable, the events that I was able to produce in Dubai. I lived in Peru for a bit and I love the cuisine. I never did business there, but the food was the best in Latin America. And the Dominican Republic had beautiful beaches. I mean, I could go on and on. And the places I lived, Colombia was nice, had some great weather, some nice people, you know. And then there were other, I lived in Bali for 8 months, but that ran its course. I went back for a visit a little over a year ago and realized I'm done. I don't think I'll go back again. I'm done. It was like that box is fully checked. No desire to go back. Probably won't. Okay. It was great. No complaint. I recommend it to anybody that wants to see a great place for yoga, but I was just done. You know, it's like you've been there, done that. It was a relationship that was over. There was no way that I was going to get a spark again.
Yeah. No, I totally get that. I get it. Well, thank you for all of that. I love that you have this adventurous spirit and you're just willing to walk out your front door and, you know, kind of accept and engage with what the day brings you. Well, the second question I always ask everybody is, did you grow up in a religious household? And if so, did that change over time for you as you got older?
100% that changed. I was raised Quaker, which is a very strict Christian religion, and left the church completely when I was 15, and I believe I was searching. I embrace today no particular religion. I do like a lot of the teachings in various religions. You know, we were talking about Pakistan earlier. I read the Holy Quran cover to cover and found it to be interesting. And I have also read the Bible. Here's what I found when you look at those two religions. They're strikingly similar more than they are dissimilar. And they're more similar than dissimilar. Buddhism has no God. Now, Christianity, Judaism and Islam all believe in one God, and monotheistic religions. Buddhism doesn't believe in God. They believe that everything is internal. And I like the principles of Buddhism because there aren't the restrictive rules of the Christians and Muslim practitioners. Some people adhere to it. I don't like to be told what to do, what I can and cannot do, how to believe. That doesn't work for me. If it works for other people, wonderful. Great. Keep it to yourself. Don't pontificate. Don't tell me how to live my life. That's why I don't, let's just say I'm not comfortable with their teachings, but I embrace and respect their teachings. Okay. There's a lot of good information. I just don't like the control element of those of Christianity and Islam.
Okay, fair. I think that's fair. I think that's fair. I was so curious. I'm going to just guess or assume that your parents were Quaker, which is why you went to a Quaker meeting house. Where did you grow up?
Grew up in LA.
In LA. And did you grow up in a neighborhood where there was a lot of variety and it was fun to be a kid and you'd play outside with everyone? Was it a really, I don't know, eccentric, fun neighborhood?
I grew up specifically in an area called Beverly Hills. So I was the lone Gentile, means non-Jew, in a Jewish neighborhood. Today, the neighborhood is very Persian. Back then, it was Ashkenazi European Jews that had settled in Beverly Hills. So I was around, I was surrounded by Jewish kids. Most of my friends today still are of that religious background or culture. And I was very comfortable in that environment. I never felt discriminated against because I wasn't one of them. I got invited to bar mitzvahs, bat mitzvahs, parties. I have no regrets about my childhood and where I grew up. I think I got exposed very well to the world. And once I left that center, because Beverly Hills is, how do I say it? It's its own culture and belief. And once I grew up and went to college, I realized there's a different mindset. There is a different level of humor. Jews kid a lot and joke. And I think I've embraced that and incorporated a lot of it into my personality. And then when I went to a conservative, more Protestant school called the University of Southern California, they didn't get me. I was a Gentile, but being exposed to all these non-Jewish kids that I was going to school with, they looked at me like I was a Martian based on some of the things I would say and do, because culturally I was more Jewish having been exposed to it. My stepfather was Jewish. My mother converted to the religion later in life. Not, I wasn't raised that way. I was not a Jew, but I would say because of my background and where I grew up, I was one of the few non-Jewish. So all of my friends were Jewish kids. And then I went to this university that was a right-wing private school, mostly Protestants, and I had difficulties, Kirsten, assimilating.
Yeah.
I had difficulty. I was a foreigner. I looked like them. I was of the same religious background, but I wasn't them. It took me a long time to realize how I was more of a personality and culture of Jewish people than I was of Protestant, which was my true background. But I didn't assimilate well. I don't know if I ever did during that time. Later now, you know, much older, sure, I've embraced, I've lived all over the world and I've spoken all over the world. I have easily assimilated and taken on different cultures and understood them. But back then, that was a difficult transition. I don't think I've talked about this in a long time. Certainly not on a podcast, not in a public platform.
So well, you know, that it's very interesting because, you know, you and I were talking that I grew up overseas and I, you know, when I went to seminary and got my Master's of Divinity, we were all in this class and it was the first time that I came to understand that me growing up overseas was a huge gift, but that one of my first great heartbreaks was coming from a school overseas where I played with kids from all over the world. Nobody cared what you ate. Nobody cared what religion you were or what you did at home, to the middle of Illinois, where suddenly everyone was white. What you wore right. was of paramount importance. What food you brought in your lunchbox was, you know, you were cool or you were a loser. I mean,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, the culture shift was just heartbreaking
massive,
for me.
Massive.
Yes. Yes. And it took me, I mean, it broke my heart. I was so confused by life. And I think, you know, that contributed. I had to do fourth grade again because I was just so confused by everything. I just did not, I could not adjust to this new world. And so it sounds like something similar that we've gone through.
Yeah, in that regard, it is different. I mean, if you grew up overseas and then to get thrust into and indoctrinated into American culture, and it's regional too. What you grew up with in Illinois, I guarantee you, was different than what I went through in LA. And then what somebody would go through in deep Texas or in South Carolina or in Boston, all distinctly different regional cultures. And you either fit in or you don't. And I don't know if I ever fit in to the university culture where I went and got my degree, University of Southern California. I didn't date girls from there, couldn't relate to them. They couldn't relate to me. And it was super strange. Everybody else was into the culture and I felt like an outsider.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that, because it's that's absolutely fascinating. And also, you know, heartbreaking for me to hear that story, because I completely can relate to what you're saying. Unfortunately, it is absolutely disorienting. And, you know, when you're not expecting it as well, when you are not expecting it and all of a sudden it kind of just comes in and cuts your knees out from under you. It is not a fun journey to go on, kind of to that understanding. But also I hear your story and I think about what a rich and beautiful childhood and just to have this, you know, group of friends or these group of neighbors, this community where you belonged and that you were accepted and everyone kind of loved who you were. That makes me really happy. So
yeah, I have no complaints about my early years. It was after 18 that things changed dramatically culturally for me. And it was a shock. It was cultural shock. The way you described is you as a 9-year-old, if you're in the fourth grade, you're about 9 years old. Mm-hmm. And then to have to assimilate and be part of that group. And American kids can be very rough.
Yeah.
And judgmental. I don't know if that happened to you at all and got judged.
True story.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I just remember being in school and thinking, wait, I'm sorry. What is Jordache? Like, what are Jordache jeans? And why is it like of paramount importance that everyone has Jordache jeans or Izod? What is this alligator that everybody has on their shirts?
You're not cool if you don't wear these particular brands.
No.
You're not cool. And for us, it was Adidas shoes. If we didn't have Adidas All-Stars, you weren't cool. If you didn't shop at this place called Rudnick's, which was a local clothing store where we had to buy our gym clothes there. It was the only place that we could buy our gym clothes with the branded gym clothes of Beverly Hills High School. And when I went to another school, which is the Grammar Junior High called Horace Mann, we had to buy our clothes there that we were mandatory. It was mandatory to wear during gym class and put in our lockers. And I just remember you had to get your clothes there. You had to have Adidas shoes, you know, or if you had an off brand, you were given a lot of flack and judgment. Oh, look at you. Look at your shoes and look at this, you know. Oh yeah. It was very brand centric. This is when Louis Vuitton and then Gucci, all this, like, what? Yeah, it was a big deal.
Yes, and kids can be not very nice.
Oh, terrible. Yeah.
Yes.
I learned to defend myself.
Oh, I'm sure.
Just physically, verbally. And that's one thing I will say, because of the environment I grew up in, I learned how to defend myself in arguments.
Really?
Yes. Oh, there was a lot of debating and attacking and defending. Yeah, you had to learn how to deal with all that verbal criticism, sharp tongues.
Wow. I mean, I'm hearing this and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, it almost kind of like you were being trained for your vocation later in life.
Pretty much. It was good early training. It's good early training. And I think many became lawyers. That could have been a different track in my life to go the legal route, but I didn't. No regrets. I think I would have had a good career doing that as well. It just didn't happen. Wasn't in the cards.
Maybe
the next life. You never know.
podcast is, I would love for you to share any story or stories, it can be more than one, where you feel like you've witnessed something magical or mysterious, something miraculous in your life, something that you can't explain. I would love for you to share any stories that you feel like sharing.
Miraculous. Wow. I will share something personal, if that's okay. In 1983, my mother and stepfather passed away 5 weeks apart, and I was an only child. I was devastated, felt abandoned emotionally and literally, and went on a downward spiral of drugs and alcohol until, so that was April and May of 1983, respectively. After that, a year later, July 1st, 1984, I decided to change my life and never drink or use again. And I have been clean and sober since. So that is my greatest achievement, which then opened many doors up in my life for the rest of my life up to this point. I mean, if I were to pass tomorrow, my tombstone would have some content. Prior to that point, it wouldn't have said much. So I think that pivot point, that miracle of being able to embrace sobriety and being able to embrace overcoming the desire has been truly miraculous for me. Now, I've never seen God. I've never seen an angel. I've never seen a meteor just miss my face, anything like that. It depends on how you define miracle. But for me, it was the miracle of making a conscious choice. It had nothing to do with anything spiritual. Don't go down that track. I don't give any God or any other entity, unknown entity, credit. The credit is me. I made the decision internally. And what then helped me put that decision into practice was the love and support of other people. Without their love and support, I doubt I would have been able to sustain that lifestyle of being drug and alcohol free. I might have slipped back because I became open. I surrendered my ego, surrendered my thought that I could do all of this on my own, and became clear that I needed help from other people. And without it, I wouldn't be successful. I've become successful. Now, how do you define success? That's all relative. My definition of that is, are you healthy, happy, productive, and are you helping other people? Are you giving back? Because at my age, as a bona fide, certified senior citizen, my goal is, and wisdom is, what I share with other people today. It's my privilege. It's not my obligation. It's my privilege. It is my privilege to be able to help other people. And that's where I come from today. So if I hope that answers your question about, you know, a magical moment or a big shift. Pretty simple.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. And I'm just going to assume here again that it wasn't even your wildest, you know, imaginings that they would pass away so close together.
Totally unexpected. My mother was sick with cancer, so that wasn't a surprise. We knew that she was going to die, but he died 5 weeks before her, stressed out about it, from a heart attack.
Oh my goodness. That is horrible. Oh, I am so sorry.
It's okay. I mean, it's a long time ago, and it's just life. It's not always fair, is it? Buddha said it really well. Life is suffering. Now get over it. I mean, that's his message. It's the beginning of Buddhism. That's the precipice of it all. Life is suffering. And have some fun times with it also. There are going to be times of suffering, especially as we get older and sick, and it happens. It's just the natural course of life.
Absolutely. And I mean, I could totally, you know, imagine just having these two events, these huge events, happen so closely together, and then just feeling like the ground has been taken away underneath your feet.
Pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine, but I also can't imagine how devastating that would be. And so I also, like, I'm like, okay, I totally get why, you went down this path. And it's a very slippery slope, right? It's a very slippery slope of, you know, maybe I'll have a drink today or two or three. And then the next day you say, maybe I'm going to have a drink.
I can never do that. I've never understood, and I can't relate to other people. Only the alcoholic relates to the alcoholic, because I don't know how someone can drink a half a glass of wine. I've already drunk the whole damn bottle before they drink a half a glass. I have no control.
Okay.
I have no control. I cannot control it. It is absolutely a problem. That's why I had to address the problem. And total abstinence was the only solution for me. Other people may have a different solution, and it wasn't for me. It was total abstinence.
Okay. And I think what I'm hearing you say is that you had people who loved you, who supported you, your community, and they said to you, hey, look, maybe this is a problem. Is that right?
Yes. Well, many people told me that. And then I sought out the help of a program, and then embraced it and followed the people that walked like they talked.
Ah, okay. Yes. I think having dear friends and having dear relationships and people in our corner who have our back, who are willing to go through whatever life throws at any of us, but still have our back. Those people are precious beyond anything that we can ever imagine, because they'll steer, you know, if we're going off in the wrong direction, hopefully they gently nudge us back so that we can follow a path that might be more healthy or more right for us or more true for us. So I am very thankful that you had those people in your life.
Yes. Yes, I am too. It's a game changer for me. I have many of my childhood friends with whom I'm still friendly with today. And I speak to a handful and stay connected. And those that some have passed, some are still around, or most are still around. And yes, it took the love and support of people to help me get through where I am today. And that wasn't just the start of getting into being drug and alcohol free. It was during my divorce, which was a different point. That was challenging. There are other challenges, you know, with relationships that didn't go well, business relationships that were challenging. People need people. People need people. Very few people can stand up and become hermits and live out it. I would not be a good example of a person that became a hermit and lived in a hut or in a shack out in the forest, living alone, hunting and being alone. That lifestyle never appealed to me. It's good for a movie. It's good to read about in a book, but to live it, I never aspired for it. I fully admit I like to engage with other people. I get my fix talking to you virtually. This is good. I haven't left the house yet today until I'm going to go to the market in a little bit, buy things to create my lunch. That's my social to get out, but I work indoors. And I fully recognize if I don't break the pattern of being alone, it can lead down a dark path. Yeah. Not a good path. We need interaction. At least I do.
Yeah. And I'm right there with you. I mean, I think sometimes, you know, when I'm just working on all my projects and I'm doing my things, I tend to kind of be in this little, I don't know, let's say, you know, hut in a forest. What you used. And then, you know, I'll just be concentrating on everything, but then I'll think, okay, I need to go out and get some groceries, and I'll go out and those interactions with, you know, maybe the gentleman who's replenishing the fruit or the person who's restocking the dairy case, or even if I bump into a friend, it's like everything, all of my energy is shifted and changed. And it's exactly the dose of happiness and levity that I needed to kind of shake me out of my kind of cave-like existence. And so you're right. People need people.
100% we do. And without it, it's a tough deal.
it. That's a wrap on my conversation with Mitch. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope it made you think about where you belong, where you find your family, where you feel like you fit in. Like I said in the intro, sometimes our family is not our biological family, and sometimes we find belonging in the places where we least expect it. To find out more about Mitch and who he is and the work he's doing in the world and just how he's moving and shaking, please click the link in the episode show notes. Now, please do remember, I'm always looking for ratings and reviews. Those ratings and reviews help other people find the podcast. And don't forget the YouTube channel, babes. I have my guests there in real life with their shining faces. It's been really fun getting those videos out there and letting people meet my guests sort of semi in real life. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Mitch. I know I've said this before, but never give up. I mean, Mitch suffered this incredible, incredible loss, and one that he didn't even know was coming. So unexpected, and cut his feet out from underneath him. And yes, he fell. Yes, there were years of suffering. Yes, there were years of loss and heartbreak. But Mitch kept going. And at some point, Mitch said, "This is enough. I can't do it anymore. You know, I don't have any other choice but to live larger than I can imagine, to have hope that the future will be better. Because I know a lot of us are suffering. I know a lot of us are sad. A lot of us are lonely. A lot of us are struggling. And sometimes when you're in the middle of that struggle, it is very, very difficult to see the way through, to even imagine that there could be a way through. I go through this as well. And it's helpful to listen to these conversations, to hear these stories, and to know that always there's a light at the end of the tunnel. So be like Mitch. Keep on going. Keep walking through that tunnel to where you see the light, because I guarantee one day you're going to wake up and you'll have reached the end of the tunnel, and everything in your life will be even more beautiful than you could have ever imagined.